Innovation Rockstars.
Innovation Rockstars.
In this episode, we welcome innovation leader and design futurist, Stephen Fisher from McKinsey.
Hi, and welcome back to the Innovation Rockstars. My name is Chris Müroth, and in this episode, I am thrilled to welcome Steve Fisher. Now, Steve is innovation leader and design futurist at McKinsey. He's a futurist, a product builder, a people leader, a maker, and an author. So, I don't know, Steve, I think it's fair to say that you're living and breathing how to leverage technology to, make everything better. Thanks for joining us. It's a pleasure having you on the show.
It's great to be here. You guys are doing great work, and it's great to talk about this topic, which is near and dear to my heart and kind of my, and it is my passion. So
it is. So let's get into that. And as always, we start straight away with a short 60 seconds introduction sprint. Now, you know, the sprint is all about you, your career, and your current role. So for the next 60 seconds, the stage is all yours. Steve, let's go.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Christian. You did a great job. I don't know if I have how much more to add to that, but I've been in the technology field for about 30 years. 20 years of that as a futurist, and technically, I've been reading software since I was 13, so I probably longer than that. I've also been a filmmaker, and I've been an entrepreneur, and I wrote and co-authored the best-selling book Startup Equation, which is about building a startup in a global sense. And I work with the Futures team. I also co-lead our internal innovation efforts here at McKinsey. What I'm a part of here is what our tech ecosystem. So we design, build, and run the technologies and the capabilities that the firm uses. And it's about, you know, world-class impact for that. Love my work. And, we are hiring, so I can share that at the end. You can go to McKinsey.com. But we have a lot of, people think it's just a strict, kind of like the consultant side, but there's a lot of really great things we're doing here at McKinsey. So, but yeah, I've been, that's kind of the sprint. You did a wonderful job, and we can dive into some things in more depth as the conversation evolves.
You bet. Absolutely. As a next thing, Steve, I would want to give you three sentence starters and would like to ask you to complete those sentences. And speed is key, right?
Yes.
So let's see. Okay. Number one, one thing nobody in corporate life knows about me is that
I'm a winemaker. And
oh, you are?
A new one at that. Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Wow. That's interesting. Have to try some. Yeah. But that's not for today's discussion. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Number two, a futurist is someone who.
That's always a great question. Many people think that a futurist predicts the future,
right?
But it's about possible futures, right? It's what a futurist is someone who looks at the trends and signals for a specific topic or an industry. That's about communicating, like I said, possible futures over a certain time horizon. And, that's for us, it's about the things that could happen in the future. And we work to identify those things so that the future will eventually become the present. But the best part of being a futurist is it allows you to take proactive action in all parts of your work and organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great answer. All right. And number three, the worst advice I hear over and over again about innovation is.
You should assign it to one person.
Oh, great. Yeah. Why is it a bad advice?
Innovation can come from anywhere, and it should be really part of an organic part of the work and the culture. Because you might have somebody that is kind of in that role of the chief innovation officer, and there's a lot of people out there that do wonderful work. But I think the important part to emphasize is that innovation can come from all parts of an organization. So being able to build that culture, and like I said, and build that within that it really becomes an easier thing to do than trying to kind of force it as a function. It becomes just naturally part of the work that a firm does.
Great. I love it. Yeah, that's great. All right. So now going forward, let's start simple and stupid. Steve, if you were to, you know, describe your job to, you say, your grandma, how would you describe it?
I would say I look at the future and where things might go. So teams can make better decisions earlier than they might and prior to that. She would understand that.
Yeah, of course, because you have a smart grandma, most probably. Yeah, but that's
She actually lived in 96. She saw wars, depression. She saw a lot of stuff. Yes, she did.
Yeah, I see. Certainly. Great question. Now, and you know, there is, in terms of definition and in terms of words and ambiguation. Now, you know, I just briefly asked you before about, you know, what a futurist is, you know, as per your definition. But there is many different other terms out there. For example, foresight, right? Strategic foresight. How would you maybe, you know, explain the difference between maybe strategic foresight or corporate foresight on the one hand, and futures or futures design on the other? What's the difference in your opinion?
That's a great question. I think for many in the audience that have looked at futures work or doing it currently, they probably know some of the history, but also where maybe some of the transitions that have happened may not be very aware of. So when you think about the decades of strategic foresight, it was a methodology. It started in the 50s with like Rand and really around wargaming. It's used by think tanks, strategy firms, governments, universities to kind of take those techniques. And, you know, they would look at possible futures, would look at a whole, you know, they look at data. It evolved into scenario planning, like techniques like that and signals. I mean, we probably all heard of Shell's scenario planning. They're probably the most, I would say, famous in those last, the kind of that second phase in the 90s and 80s to really look in a long, long horizon as to where energy's going. But that's kind of where things stopped. And what's been interesting in the last, I would even 20 years is even in the last 10 is how we communicate the future to people, especially people that are not very futures fluent, as I like to say. And many talk the futures fluency, right? You'll hear that term probably mentioned a few times in our conversation. What you might be familiar with is companies like IDEO and their way that they prototype. You would see kind of radical concepts or, you know, you'd see like future designs, but even something like a story, like a Philip K. Dick story, like things like what are called design fiction. What they do is they help communicate the future. And what I, in my role as a design futurist is there's techniques that have evolved like design fiction, speculative prototyping in a more common way. It helps communicate those concepts and experiences to people. And that's a very powerful way to get people bought into a vision, but also to drive them toward that future world, you know, how you live, you work, you play in it. And that's I feel is an exciting aspect to the evolution of futures work, because it really connects the possible to those who really not live a day to day, but can really kind of grasp it and truly, like you said earlier, like explain to your grandma, this kind of does that for you, for them.
And how do you, you know, help people embrace the fact that there is more than just one possible future, or even more than one plausible future, right? Because you know, it's about communication. Sure, it's about telling them, you know, maybe a story of what might be, of what's again possible or plausible, maybe even desired or not. But you know, then they probably come up with a question like, okay, now what do we believe in the most? Like, where should we go, left or right? Or what do I, you know, take from this to make my decisions in terms of product investments or even, you know, changing the strategy? So, you know, how do you typically deal with that? That people still, you know, leave the room and say like, oh yeah, that's interesting, but, you know, now I have so many ideas and so many options. I don't know how to turn this into action.
That's a great question. When I talked about strategic foresight, a lot of it was around scenarios, which was a lot of, and it also was a little bit more narrow. You had really kind of, let's say, rigid, like the future is going one way. It's either going to go fantastically awesome, you know, or it's going to be an apocalyptic nightmare and a little, and maybe a few in between, but it was kind of like one path, the other. I think in my work, and I know others as well, is there's a plurality of futures, right? Because, you know, one person's future could be wonderful and the same time they're living in it, somebody else is having kind of their own hellscape. So it's like, how do you deal with the multiple, I would call it the plural verse. And that's that plurality of futures is defined better now, but I mentioned like where scenario stopped. A lot of organizations would do scenario planning and it would just kind of go into a report and into a drawer and that would be great.
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. It was like, good luck. Exactly. Good luck storming the castle. What has evolved too in the kind of farther end is things called backcasting. So one of the aspects of doing product or type of strategy work is taking that type of time horizon, 5 years, 7, 10, 15, 20, whatever that is, and working backwards. So if you want your organization or your product to be in a certain place or the things that you envision 10 years from now, you have to connect the dots. And I think backcasting is a very powerful tool in that way. And what it does is it allows you to look at, map up the trends and the signals that are that are going to come into play at certain points, according to kind of, you know, what is projected, right? And it allows you to say, if we're going to make these changes, this is probably the best time horizon to do these. And this is where we'll get there. And it also helps people understand that you're not going to throw money at something that's hopefully 10 or 20 years away, but there's demonstrable action that can be done beyond maybe a typical roadmap of a product, which is like maybe 12 to 18 months, but it maybe looks out 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, and helps really and inform the large organization. But the beauty of it too is that as the future becomes the present, you're able to kind of see those signals come into play maybe quicker. So you maybe have to take action faster, or you know that something's going a different way and you don't have to invest in those ways, which can really be powerful, especially to you know, stakeholders, shareholders that are in the organization. So I think that's a way to do it. So,
and that's fine. And then maybe we can talk about a different study, a study by Professor Rohrbeck, also a study published quite a few years ago. I guess it was in the journal TFSC, so Technological Forecasting Social Change, you know, where he did a longitudinal analysis, some evidence that future prepared firms did outperform, you know, the average by, I don't know, a 30% or somewhat more than a 30% higher profitability and, you know, double the growth, which is quite interesting. So what he's basically saying is if you're prepared for the future, you're going to outperform better because at least, you know, obviously you can't predict and you can't look into the future, but you have the options, you're preparing earlier than anybody else. So that's quite interesting. Is that what you're seeing too? Does, you know, in your experience and the work you do with other leading organizations as well, do they, you know, excel in certain things because they start embracing, you know, futures design and any other of these techniques, or, you know, what do you see when you work with others?
Yeah, that's a fascinating study, and I one that I often cite. In fact, there is a we can get into a little later in the conversation, but I worked on co-authored a paper with McKinsey Global Institute on Asia, and that we mentioned that we reference that a lot because what I think is powerful about that study is a longitudinal study. Right. They took 10 years and looked at firms in this way. And that really showed that when you need to build this capability in an organization, there's actually the investment gave better responsiveness and the input into the strategic decision making, which, you know, avoided costing mistakes. I mean, it's a compelling effect. And something to cite on many, many ways. What I often talk to people about is that the opportunity is not just with, say, one part of an organization, is actually bringing this into all facets of an organization. Because the way that the investment can look is that if you, and it shows they also looked at those who didn't, or maybe to kind of abandon foresight, they actually had lower performance. So I think I think it's something that shows that for those who are maybe financially minded and investment minded, that this is, you know, doing this has a tangible impact. So.
Yeah. And now connecting to that, I mean, Steve, when we talked earlier, I've actually learned that you're on a mission, right? And the mission you said was to democratize future thinking. Now that sounds compelling. Tell me more about that.
So many of your listeners are probably familiar with design thinking. It's been around for a while, right? That kind of a problem-solving approach, which also here at the firm is one of our methods that we leverage. And it's very powerful, right? It's about looking at a problem, iteration, and the way that we kind of approach creating a product or doing innovation work, right? Well, it began its life inside of design agencies and design departments probably about, you know, around the 2010s. We talk about the history, who created it, but that's for another conversation. Right. But it recognized that push. But what's happened is that it's been everyone who's maybe not even in design knows what design thinking is. They've been in workshops or sprints, and it's really, really great in that it's democratized and helped educate everyone. But that's for current challenges, right? That's the things in those like short things we need to add to the roadmap. We need to figure out something in short term. What we've seen, especially with the pandemic, you know, as people shifted to different types of work, living, I mean, the whole world, and the bottom line is that there's a whole level of uncertainty and a need for resiliency, right? And then future thinking is needed more than ever. So the opportunity for I believe, is that this decade is that there's an opportunity to democratize futures thinking this decade to help organizations and individuals all over the world be prepared for the future, like you said, to create it, not just react, but navigate and thrive in it. Like just like design thinking was last decade. And that's what I'm kind of on a mission, quest to evangelize. I think it's very powerful.
Absolutely. What do you think is required to, you know, further democratize future thinking? Is it to, you know, teach futures literacy? Did you call it futures literacy before that? Is it that? Is it to provide them with tools? Is it maybe even, I don't know, collaboration to a certain extent? Well, you know, talking about open foresight, open scouting and things like that. So what is required to get there? How can we get there?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think a lot of times that futures thinking and strategic foresight has been overcomplicated in many ways. It's tried to create the complexity to show how important it is, but in a way it's made it harder to implement. And just like those who did take the challenge, they've seen performance increases and growth in that way. The opportunity for us, just like if you think of like design thinking, there is design sprints, thinking the ways that are steps in communicating signals, like you said, open signals research, open getting trends together, creating larger libraries. One of the biggest challenges with futures work is trying to find the right trends in the signals, doing the good old fashioned desk work to bring the themes in to actually have the right conversations. I think it's also the tools, originally open sourcing, you know, how to build a scenario, how to do a futures wheel. Like there's a lot of good training out there. I've benefited from some of that, but there's a lot of people in the world who don't have access to it. There needs to be equitable access to that. And I think that it, for me, and the creating stuff in the commons is really a great opportunity. I think organizations like Design Futures Institute is wonderful. They bring together futurists from all over the world, and they have chapters all over the world. And it's a great way to really just connect with people. And I think from there, there's a lot of actionable activity on a local level, and then with those tools together. So you have to find the local action with the maybe globally shared resource that you can then take action. And I think that over time, it will then spread, because, like, again, teach to fish, right? And then that'll create, hopefully, a wave. So that's what
And taking action is... you know, triggered me because I 100% agree, you know, with everything you said. And, you know, some of the conversations we have is that, you know, we see organizations create, you know, beautiful, you know, trend radars, technology radars, maybe even competitor radars, you know, so radar charts basically showing their assumption on what's next. And that's really helpful for, you know, sparking conversations. Get everybody on the same page, make sure you don't overlook something. So there's a lot of value and benefits in doing that and having this as a continuous process and then communicating it, for example, through a radar, being, you know, it might be a closed activity, it might be an open one, it might be in your community whatsoever. But then, you know, oftentimes it stops here, right? And then they say, well, okay, now we have a nice looking trend radar. We have had some great conversations. Beautiful. What do we do with that, right? So helping them to actually transform this into an actionable thing is a challenge we see, you know, identifying future opportunities out of this, making sure they actually also, you know, walk the talk, not only talk the talk. It has become quite challenging. What's your view on that? Why is it, you know, that it's just feeling hard to be very actionable, and you know, just look at the report or now look at the trend radar and say, well, great job, everybody, great. But no action is following.
Yeah, it's. I think there's a disconnect between the activity and the action. Mm-hmm. I think what happens is there is a great momentum around the activity to do futures thinking because it's exciting. It kind of allows you to break free, just like with design thinking, right? It kind of allows you to get out of the building, really think differently, right? But then it's like you get to the end of the sprint, like it's like, draw some parallels, right? So design sprint at the end, you kind of have your prototype, you've done some testing. Well, okay, great. Why don't we actually have to build a live prototype? We have to build a live prototype. And the need of organizations, if you're doing that, is there's a probably funding behind that. There's a desire to do that, right? There's a financial need. There's a drive to take the action. What will really benefit others if they're thinking of doing the activity is to get support for the action, right? Mm-hmm. So if there is outcomes, let's say they're trying to do the future of, I don't know, future of food in a certain city, right? How do you, let's just talk about, or future of voting or democracy, right? Whatever those outcomes, they need to have awareness with those who would benefit from it and ensure that, okay, we're going to come up with this. Are you going to be able to take action? Are we going to be able to then kind of work with you to make, you know, these potential projects or initial futures outcomes possible? I think that's unfortunately what happens in a lot of places. And again, it's the more people that I think that understand futures work and design futures and how to communicate it, the easier it will be to get people involved and mm-hmm. also to get them active to maybe carry on. Because if you know, think about organizations, you know, you think about really great leaders and different phases of organizations, right? There are different CEOs for different phases, right? There's the person for the big merger, right? But once the merger's done, there's the integration, right? There may be a different person, right? There's a person for the turnaround, right? It's the same thing. There are futurists who maybe are good at a certain aspect, maybe the thinking, the scenario, but then there are maybe, I would say, different kinds of active futurists. And that's why, like me as a design futurist, I know the normative integrative type of general work practice, but at the same time, I have very specific skill sets that benefit parts that can take it to a different place, right? And I think further defining that and further finding ways to get people engaged with their gifts to bring that, I think is going to be, it's a journey. it's just like, it's a democracy. It's not going to be something tomorrow, but it's a wonderful question because it is. I think it's a, We have to think thoughtfully about how we do that.
Exactly. That was what I was aiming for. And you know, it's also as you mentioned earlier, and I love what you were saying was like, you need to also have a strong focus on communication, and but do this in a mindful way, I guess. Just recently. Mm. I had a couple of conversations on like, you know, there were some, you know, people doing strategy work and, you know, corporate strategy and making sure they, think about the future and maybe potential strategic moves they need to do and implications on the product and technology and so on. Mm-hmm. So there is maybe a closed group discussing this and then strategizing and applying futures thinking on the one hand. And then, but on the other hand, you have the actual people who have to implement that, say engineers, say R&D departments, say, you know, the people that actually come up with the technology, develop that technology. Now, there seems to be a slight disconnect between those groups because the ones, you know, think about the future and that, you know, the people from technology are like, come on, we are in this for 25 years. You know, we kind of, you know the technology, we know what's possible, what not. And now you being, you know, strategy people want to tell me what the future looks like. So there is, you know, a clash of interests, maybe if you don't involve them early enough in the process and so on. What do you see, you know, typical pitfalls in that process when organizations try to apply future thinking or even democratize it further in the organization? Are there any pitfalls to look out for and not tap into that?
Yeah, I think you mentioned some of the engineering teams. I think it's about finding those who are futures minded. I think like we talked about culture, right? About innovation and culture and building it into the way that people work. I think it's also a challenge. People have their current work to do, but there's also an opportunity to build, you know, I actually think if there's real creation of product or something in terms of that way, creating incentive or ways to do that as part of their personal development or the team's developments, but the organization, I think it makes a real valuable connection that they're not just kind of more like feeling like a volunteer, but actually this is contributes to my work. And I think tools like backcasting, we talked about before, bring things into a closer horizon, and then they feel people want to feel connected to a positive future, but they very much need tangible outcome sooner. And I think with creating those connections, I think, is it the answer? No, probably no. There's probably 20 ways to do this, but what I've seen.
That's super helpful. Super helpful. All right. And we are quite far ahead actually with the conversation, Steve. Maybe we can start thinking of, you know, summarizing some of the things we discussed in the conversation. Sure. Well, I don't know, what would be the, let's say, three key takeaways for the listeners, you want listeners to take away from the conversation we had today?
Wow. You know, everyone I think should bring futures thinking into their work. You know, they think that there are many possible futures. And if you can understand yours, you can be prepared to thrive in it. I think that there is a real opportunity to make this a differentiating part of your career or of your work, so that it helps you stand out professionally, but also in not just in the day-to-day work, but maybe in outside volunteer or other things that you're a part of, that allows you to bring this skill set into helping people think differently and more, and I would say more positively and proactively. So those are the things I would recommend.
Awesome. And now let's look ahead, you know, let's look at your future maybe. So Steve, what can we expect from you in the future?
Oh, well, I just want to continue, you know, speaking about future trends.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to write another book soon in the future. You know, I mean, one of the things I got a chance to do was, you know, applying that we have the approach that we use at the firm called Design by Foresight, and was able to work. We could put the link in the show notes, but it's called Imagining Customers' Possible Futures. So that allowed us to it was work with the Future of Asia project, and it allowed us to kind of take a look at how people might live in 2030. And I think that was a great opportunity for us to kind of show the work, the kind of future thinking we can do. And I hope to do more of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me also, I want to make some great wine that my friends and family will enjoy. So, and of course, you know, with that all collectively, you know, democratizing futures. So thanks.
Yeah. All right. So still on the mission. Sure. That's
still
great.
Mission.
Exactly. And finally, if you would look back on your professional career, you know, I have to ask you this, Steve. I want to hear from your greatest innovation rockstar moment so far.
Yeah, it was, I wrote the book Startup Equation actually with my wife. So if you really want to know your wife or your spouse better, write a book with them. You'll figure a lot out. And it was actually a great fun. We found a lot of where our strengths our opportunities for growth are. And we worked with that and found a lot of great insights. We built from that book. We also built an organization called the Revolution Factory, which was, and she's still running it, but it's still designed for helping entrepreneurs. And that for me, the book has gone, we have translations into Chinese, Korean, Japanese. They're a fascinating look at the different covers for me.
Wow.
And I know it's used globally, but we've helped at least 100,000, as far as we know right now, about 100,000 entrepreneurs all over the world create and launch new businesses. And this goes from the, you know, the Kiva loan shops, places in Africa, to coffee shops in Europe, to mobile startups in Silicon Valley. So that's for us, it was again, kind of maybe democratizing startup approaches. So that was a big theme of my world, but that's what I'm very proud of that. I'm very, very, very thankful to be able to share that and help others maybe avoid the things we both did over the years with that. So.
Yeah, but that is not even a rockstar moment, but it's an entire rockstar period. That's great. Congratulations to that. Sounds really compelling. And Steve, for that, that's it. We did it, Steve. Thanks so much again for being my guest on this episode. And as always, it was a pleasure to listen to you. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, that's great. And if you're into the future, come work with me. Come over to this to Cap McKinsey and come on work. We have some great stuff, and I'm very excited to see where your organization goes. And again, thank you for the time today. And well, to the future we go.
That's it. Thanks, Steve. And to everybody listening or watching, if you want to learn more about the concept and all the different things we discussed today, you know, simply leave us a comment on this episode or just drop us an email at info@innovationrockstars.show. Now that's it. Thanks for listening. Take care and bye-bye.
This was innovation rockstar Stephen Fisher of McKinsey about strategic foresight and future design. If you would like to give us feedback on this episode or know someone, perhaps yourself, who also has some thrilling stories or insights to share from the world of corporate innovation, just shoot us a note at info@innovationrockstars.show. If you like the show, then leave us a rating and recommend it to others. For more inspiring innovation stories, visit our website at www.innovationrockstars.show or browse through our Innovation Rockstars channel on all major podcast platforms.